This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporter Roundtable Thursday, and it means we'll chat with some of our colleagues who have covered topics and the like for their print media and other media as well, too. In this case, first we start out with some very interesting columns that have come out in the Indianapolis Star, also on IndyStar.com, from Matt Tully. Matt is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star. He's also, I guess you could say, Matt, that you are, I guess, a region rat in a way. You grew up in Gary and Portage, so I guess that officially qualifies you as being a region rat, doesn't it?
You know, I did about 25 years up there. So
yeah.
I think I'll always
You probably have. What we're talking today is not so much about being a resident of the region, but about how interesting it must be, although maybe not necessarily to be a political observer, but certainly to be a political candidate, if you are at least one of three people who are fighting it out. And as I mentioned in our opening remarks here about being what has been dubbed by the Associated Press as the nation's nastiest primary election. And we're talking, of course, about the three-person race for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to go up against Democrat Senator Joe Donnelly in November. And some interesting columns, to say the least. The latest of which, I guess, is just recently here talking about what you call 10 thoughts about the latest Republican Senate debate here. And also one other article too has an interesting headline too about some lessons that that Todd Rokita, who is one of the three Republican candidates, should learn. Well, let's start out. I'll let you take which column do you want to take up first here? They're all interesting.
Well, thank you very much. I think they're both kind of cut from the same cloth, which is that, you know, this has been a pretty disappointing primary election. And when you think of all the money that's being spent, all the attention that's being paid, and the importance of this race, it really has been a petty and juvenile campaign. And I wouldn't argue that any of the three candidates for the GOP nomination have run particularly great campaigns, but I think it's pretty easy to sit back and look at this and see that Todd Rokita has been by far the most lowbrow of the candidates and the one who probably set the tone for the campaign from the beginning. You know, campaigns, elections can go all sorts of ways. And from the very beginning, you know, a year ago, he just decided that this is going to be a bomb-throwing campaign that was pretty much devoid of substance and was more about personal attacks, and that kind of set the tone for the campaign. And you know, you mentioned the column, Three Things You Could Learn. You know, that was just based on the fact that, hey, this guy could be a United States senator 8 months from now, and you know, maybe he should start acting like it.
Well, you would think that for such a high office as that, you know, regardless of what political party you happen to belong to or you're running in whatever campaign it is, that you should probably take that kind of attitude, that you should take the high road.
Well, you know, I spent 5 years out in Washington covering the Senate, and this was about 15 to 20 years ago, and it wasn't perfect back then. It was very partisan. It was you know, you had all kinds of problems, but at that point there was still a sense that, hey, this is the Senate, and our job is to get things done, and even if we have silly partisan fights, we're still going to at least try to get things done and occasionally work together, and that's kind of gone away for the most part the last few years, and the Senate, in my view, is acting more like the House. You know, the House has always been more the kind of rabble-rousing partisan chamber, and the Senate's been where things cool down. And you know, if you just look at the rules of the Senate, 6-year terms, so much more power given to each individual senator.
Oh, yeah.
It really was built to be the place where you have more thoughtful debate. And we already have a problem with that. And you know, if you're just going to add more bomb throwers like Todd Rokita to the mix, I think it just gets worse. One thing I wrote in that column was, and I've largely been offered a lot of praise to the current Senator Joe Donnelly for the last 6 years. But one thing I reminded people was, you know, this is a Senate seat that was held by Richard Lugar for 36 years. And if there's anyone who kind of upheld the, you know, what we want to see out of the Senate and a senator, it was Richard Lugar. And that was part of the column, was trying to remind these these guys running for the seat, hey, you know, this is the seat that Richard Lugar held for a long time. Maybe you could learn a little bit by how he acted.
Well, you think, too, and I guess this, if you wanted to make some light of it, you could talk about the fact that you're vying for an office that, kind of like Superman, you've got powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal man. Well, okay, yeah. It's not quite that superb, but that is the point. It's such a prestigious position to be in, and if you're a U.S. senator, you get a lot more attention than if you're just some representative, and even Mike Pence would probably have dreamt at one in his career before he became vice president that being a senator would be a very nice job as opposed to being just a simple congressman.
Yeah, if you think of it, I mean the way the rules are set in the Senate, one senator can stop pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the power to, you know, both the filibuster, but also just the holds on bills and nominations and things. And there's only 100 of them. And we're at a time where, for the most part, with the exception of, you know, a couple of years here and there, the Senate's been very closely divided between the two parties. You know, sometimes Democrats have had a 2 or 3 seat edge and sometimes Republicans have, but it's been very close. And in a chamber where you need 60 votes to get a lot of things done just because of the rules, it gives each individual senator so much power. And I think that's why generally voters have put a lot more thought into who they send to the Senate than maybe who they send to the House or some of the other offices. And, you know, we saw it in here in Indiana 6 years ago when Republicans nominated, a guy who was seen as far outside the mainstream and said a lot of problematic things. And even though it was a very pro-Republican year in Indiana in the elections in 2012, they elected Democrat Joe Donnelly. Mm-hmm. I think that's because, you know, I think people think a little bit more about who they're going to send to the Senate because I think most people know that it's not just any office. It's a pretty high office.
Yeah, we're not avoiding names, but we're talking here about a fellow named Murdoch. Who made a rather big fool of himself, unfortunately. Otherwise, he probably would be in Joe Donnelly's position there in the Senate.
That was his race. I mean, it was pretty much all he had to do was go and hide for 6 months, and he would have won that election.
Yeah.
But if you remember, he said one crazy thing after another, and then finally said something extremely, offensive to a lot of people in a debate, and that was the end of that campaign. And here we are 6 years later, Joe Donnelly has a tough road. This is a Republican state. It's more Republican now than it has been in a long time. And he's pretty much the last Democrat standing. If you look at all the statewide office holders, if you look at the General Assembly and our congressional delegation, there are a couple U.S. reps from Democrat areas like Indianapolis and up in your neck of the woods. But other than that, it's pretty much Joe Donnelly is the last Democrat standing.
We're talking to Matt Tully, who is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star. You can catch his columns at IndyStar.com. We've been talking here primarily at first here about the three-person U.S. Senate race for the Republican nomination. And we also know, too, that they have had some debates. In fact, one of the latest columns you have, and I would also want to get a little bit, too, about the next really big debate that's coming up, too, mm-hmm. before we wrap up here. Yeah, let's talk about the other column talking about, the last one that happened, which was up in Fort Wayne. And you had 10 thoughts about the latest Republican Senate debate.
I didn't either. That was a debate that I just decided to watch on TV and just kind of keep notes on my thoughts. And honestly, I went into that thinking, hey, I'm going to give this a fair shot. If this is a solid debate, I will write that it's a solid debate. And it ended up being, a pretty testy debate without a whole lot of deep thoughts on issues. And some of the issues, particularly on whatever your views are on the gun issue or the budget issue, some of the answers were extremely showed the lack of seriousness that this race has been marked by. And then also, one thing I noted was even though these are three Republicans, and I know politics is an act in a lot of cases, these truly seem like three Republicans who do not like each other.
Yeah.
And that's a symptom of the fact that we are now, just less than 2 weeks away from the election, And it's a toss-up. It's a three-person race, and I think for a long time, people thought it was going to be between the two U.S. representatives, Rakita and Messer. And the outsider candidate, Mike Braun, who's a former, spent a small amount of time as a state legislator and as a businessman, he's been able to kind of portray his opponents as insiders and effectively portray himself as kind of the outsider, which is a pretty popular view among the GOP base. So, you know, a lot of people, he's the front runner now, but either way, I think this is a race that I don't think I'd be surprised by any outcome on May 8th. And because of that, you're seeing it get a little nastier by the day.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could even, it's almost like watching an episode of the Bad Girls Club, I suppose, you know. The way that they were fighting. Yeah, I understand here, and you mentioned in the column here talking about that latest debate here about the fact that everybody's calling each other's names, and it's certainly, as you mentioned, it's more for what the fact that they don't like about each other as much as whether they figure they could be a better congressperson or a senator rather than not, and that you would think that somebody who's been in Congress would be able to take it off as we've started in our conversation and go on the high road, it would have been much better now. So we're all looking forward to this final big debate that the Indiana Debate Commission is going to be putting on. We're going to carry, of course, here on Lakeshore Public Radio. But I guess we'll have to wait to see, too, the most interesting, not only of the candidates debating, but about the moderator. Tell us about the fellow who's a character quite literally in his own right himself and how he is going to fit into this last debate.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a column about this. I don't usually write about my colleagues in the media, but Abdul Hakim Shabazz is going to be the moderator. And he's down here in Indianapolis. He's a reporter slash pundit slash kind of political insider. Does all kinds of things. And I will, as I acknowledge in the column, he's a friend of mine for 10 years. And he's from Chicago, but he's more conservative and tends to side with the Republicans. So he's very popular with Republicans. I've never heard of a Republican say a bad word about him until Todd Rakita decided for some reason to attack him and initially say he wasn't going to participate in the debate because Abdul is a big liberal, which is just, you know, the most, if you followed politics down here at all for the last 10 years, it's a ridiculous statement. Well, Abdul is not a liberal. And
that comment right there had to make people take a second take on that, you know, say, what?
Yeah, absolutely.
What did he just say? Much?
That's one thing that's cracked me up about this Republican primary is how liberally the candidates throw around the term liberal, and they're even calling each other liberals. Which is, you know, if you followed Todd Rakita or Luke Messer or Mike Braun at all during their careers, you know, like him or not, they are not liberals. So it's kind of funny to see the very, you know, each of them calling each other liberals, which, you know, it's just a strange thing. And so they did that with Abdul. Todd Rakita eventually, realized he kind of looked silly. It probably never hurts you in a Republican primary. It's going to be a low turnout primary driven by the pro-Trump base. So it probably never hurts you to get into a little war with the media, which I think was what his goal was. But he eventually, I think, realized that not being on what is going to be the most watched of all the debates wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So I think he's going to show up on Monday. And I think this is, you know, these political debates don't get a whole lot of attention. And I don't talk to too many people that aren't political junkies who watch them. But I think this might be, based on the attention that race has gotten in the last few weeks, I think this actually might be a debate that gets a few more eyeballs than usual. So it'll be interesting to see if any of the three candidates can find a way to separate themselves from the other two.
Yeah. And here again, coming back to the start of our conversation, talking about taking the high road, maybe this will be an opportunity that everybody will see three people decide that maybe they should kind of at least take a step or two on that high road and see if they can finish up the cycle of debates here with some positive note, I would imagine, too. So, well, Matt, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking time to talk with us. And these are great columns. As I said, you can catch them online at IndyStar.com and check out the latest about the debate. So, and in particular about the entire U.S. Senate race when the Republican Party's concerned for this election cycle. And Matt, as always, thank you very much. We'll be watching these columns, and we'll be back with you soon, we hope.
Thanks so much.
Take care. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio, a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Hey, Rob, how are you today?
Hey, what's up, Chris? I'm good.
I was going to start by saying something smarmy, like he covers all things Crown Point. Well, at least in these stories, you certainly did, to be sure. You cover all kinds of stories around the region, but we have three interesting points from Crown Point to talk about, one of which we'd gotten a clue was going to happen several weeks ago when the big word came out by way of news release about this kissing couple statue. And when I first saw that, I had to go back and dig into my Best of Life book, my big coffee table book that has a nice big black and white picture of exactly the scene we're talking about, which I didn't know that there was more than one photo, but it doesn't surprise me, I suppose.
Right, yeah. This is a popular statue. In fact, it was in Florida before it came here, and they wanted to keep it, and they fought to keep it. But it's been all over the world. You know, it's based, of course, on the VJ photo, you know, the embrace that happened in Times Square at the end of the war. And it's in Times Square at one point, they had dozens of couples recreate the kiss underneath the statue. So I'm wondering if that's going to happen in Crown Point.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. That's good. That would be interesting, but I would just have to wait to see how many couples in Crown Point will do that. If you had many, many couples on Times Square, you know, well, I mean, where the statue is going to be is not quite that big, but it's
right.
It's pretty good size space. That'd be interesting. So, tell us a little bit more about the sculptor, the fellow who's put this thing together originally. And you say it's last been seen in Florida, but it's gone all over the country, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the world. That particular sculpture has been in Rome, Italy, and France, Normandy, and several museums out there. The artist is Stuart Johnson, and he's still doing this. I think he's in his 80s, maybe 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. And this is the third monument statue that Crown Point has gotten in the last 3 years. You know, it's a few years ago, I don't know if you remember, they had the big Abraham Lincoln statue out there. And then last year was the giant tooth, which they just extracted Monday when they put in the kissing couple statue. And it goes along with the common man statues they put around the downtown square. Actually, this year they're not going to do that. They're going to have a set of statues on the courthouse lawn, based on that famous painting, Monet painting called "The Hunting Party."
Yeah,
and they'll be up until about November. Although the statue might stay till next May, but that hasn't been determined yet.
It's interesting. So these are interesting statues, and it seems that the city of Crown Point has made it a point, quite definitely, to make themselves kind of a destination for interesting artifacts of art like this.
Yeah, and they're working on a new project actually too, where they paint angel wings on the side of a building, and then people will go and pose in front of, you know, with the wings to their back. Mm-hmm. And this has also been going on all over the country. I can't remember the name of the artist who developed it, but they're talking about doing that at one of the walls in the downtown square, where you know, would attract visitors to take their photos with the angel wings. But Carol Drazka, the councilwoman, a lot of credit goes to her because she's, you know, big into this whole arts thing and drawing people to the city.
Yeah, I know that many people with South Shore Arts think very highly of Carol, and she's worked very hard to promote these ideas and get these interesting things set up in Crown Point to draw attention to the city, to say the least. So,
that's cool.
One of the other great stories that you had, and I'll let you take us and explain it in more detail, is the tale of a fellow from Crown Point who had probably one of the largest water utility bills it's probably ever been seen in the region, if not ever, then maybe certainly in a really long time, and mm-hmm. and how the city's Board of Public Works and Safety managed to deal with it.
Yeah, it's been the last couple of meetings. There have been several residents, including I think you're talking about that one business owner. I don't remember how many gallons, but it was in the multiple thousands and thousands.
Yes,
his bill was $5,000. And his, you know, for the month, over that month, it was $5,000. And normally it's $51. So there's something going on with their flagging system. The week before, they had a woman whose bill was $3,000, and her bills normally, I think, was also around $50. And so it's not catching it. it's you know, I go to a lot of meetings, and every other meeting, you'll have someone approach the Council of Board of Works saying, hey, can you help me out? You know, I was out of town, or some kid turned on my outdoor spigot and I had a leak. But I've never, you know, it's not often that it's this high of an amount. And it doesn't sound like they're even sure what's going on. So they're trying to fix this. They're having more employees check their flagging system, where a little flag goes up when it shows that someone's using too much water. But as in that one business owner's case, he was out of town for a lot of that, and they put it on him a little bit too for not being there to check his business for, you know, that it was leaking. So yeah, they ended up splitting that cost, him and the town, and I mean the city. But hopefully it's fixed. But yeah, there were several people in the last, you know, month or so that in the thousands of dollars that the city has had to eat and the water bill.
Well, I wonder what Mayor David Duran has to say about this. He can't be very happy about losing so much revenue in this case. You know, they have to split the bill.
Right. Yeah, he said multiple flags should have went up. And I know one of the Board of Works members said, you know, he said he's been there like a decade and he's never seen it this high, these amounts this high. So, and it's a little mystery of how the system works. I'm still trying to find out. And it's just, I know they're trying to fix it. The Board of Works, the public works director said, you know, they don't know anything, and unless they're told or there's a flag, they don't know to go out there and check anything. So, it's pretty interesting. Maybe not for the mayor, but other people.
Well, Rob, let's cover the last story that you had in the paper here recently and online as well too, talking about again to the city of Crown Point, their new emergency management agency offices.
Yeah, right now they're in that old, ancient civil defense building downtown Crown Point, right next to City Hall. Half that building was, well, they were there. Half of that building was the EMA, and then the other half they use for, like, senior activities. Well, the senior activities are going to move to the new Bulldog Park, which next week they're having the groundbreaking for.
Yeah.
And the EMA needed more space, so they took over the old Lake County Highway Department building, just like northeast of downtown, not that far. And all the EMA volunteers that have been doing all the work on rehabbing the place, and it's really nice. You know, they have room for their cars and all their equipment. And so they just moved in there, and they're going to probably redevelop the old building downtown. I heard they might tear it down or just do something else with it, but that building's, you know, ancient beyond its use. So
that's good. They probably appreciate the extra space, like you say, with the vehicles and all the other equipment that they've been trying to squeeze into the space that they had been using. They probably are very happy about this too. Hey, while I have you here to talk, if there is anything here, is there any update on the plans for a new city hall in Crown Point? That is to replace the crappy looking greenhouses which is on the property right now, I guess.
Yeah, they're right now they're going through the bids for the demolition of those, and that's going to start very soon. Those will be gone very, very soon. I think in the matter probably sometime in May, I believe.
Oh,
they're going to start tearing those down, and that's the first. That's, you know, one step, and then after that, you know, they'll start building the new city hall and police department that'll go there.
That's great.
Yeah, there'll be a nice bike trail going through there, and it'll be a nice development. And I'm not sure what they're going to do to City Hall. That'll probably be redeveloped, or like the civil defense building next to it. They'll do something, whether they tear it down or just sell it or use it for office space, for rent it, lease it, sell it, whatever.
Robert Earnshaw is a reporter. He covers stories in the city of Crown Point and other communities here in Northwest Indiana for the Times. Rob, thanks very much for being with us, and hope to have a chance to check back in with you soon.
Cool. Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
Take care. You're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Month of April is Parenting Awareness Month here in Indiana, and the Indiana Parenting Institute, which is based here in the region, uses this occasion to help educate and support people in the very critical position of being a parent. And Jaina Beleza is the Vice President of Strategic Partnerships and Branding for the local chapter of the IPI. It's based out of Gary. And she says that Parenting Awareness Month is a way to be able to draw people's attention to parenting and the challenges it presents. And she had a chance to talk recently with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about it.
So Parenting Awareness Month, Indiana. So its whole purpose is to get folks' attention on parenting. You know, the struggles of it, the challenges of it, and the rewards of it. You know, we want folks to take this opportunity to acknowledge and celebrate the parents that are part of their organization, part of their church, part of their community, you know, and to get us realizing that that job that we can sometimes be very critical about is not very easy. And so at times they need assistance, and understanding that instead of being critical of the outcomes from their parenting, we'll be more inclined to support them and to help guide them in the right direction, if you will. So that's what April is Parenting Awareness Month Indiana is all about.
So what other events do you have planned for Parenting Awareness Month Indiana, and why is that month important?
The reason we chose April is because of the Prevent Child Abuse campaign.
I wanted to like get a quick recap of April is Parenting Awareness Month Indiana and what your goals were for that, and maybe just a quick recap of some of the events.
So I don't know if you are also aware, but April is also Prevent Child Abuse Month. And so kind of our corollary to that movement was to, or to that initiative, was to do an initiative called April is Parenting Awareness Month Indiana. And basically what that does is draw attention not just to child abuse prevention, but also to the really tough task of parenting. And so it's a time, it's an opportunity and a time for us to acknowledge our parents, to reach out to them if they're doing a great job, and letting them know that we see the great job that they're trying to do as they raise their child, or if they're struggling, to be there for them in their struggle and to let them know that we support them even through their struggles. If there's anything that they need, to please, you know, reach out to us. Or here's some information, or here's some resources that you can access to make that job a little easier. You know, I think the important thing about solving a problem is getting our focus on it, because once our focus is on something, together especially, we can come up with solutions for it, you know. And so if we're all only looking at the negative outcomes of parenting as opposed to also highlighting those positive outcomes, we fail an opportunity to give people examples of what good parenting looks like, because a lot of us learn by example. In fact, I'd say a high majority of us learn by example, you know, and that's what teaching is in those younger years. And giving them those opportunities to see something to emulate, I think, is a positive thing in the end, as opposed to consistently remanding them about the things that they aren't doing right. Right. So, and then instead of, you know, reprimanding them for not doing something correctly, you know, showing that empathy and compassion to get them in the right direction. So that's what we wanted to give to parents, so that it's not a month of, you know, of highlighting the mistakes that parents have made, but also an opportunity to give them that support as they're being made aware of some of the bad choices that they've made and the outcomes of those bad choices.
So do you guys have, like, extra educational programs during that time, during April?
Well, what we try to do is, it's kind of really a branding thing, if I may be bluntly honest, in terms of we want parents to know activities that that they can feel safe or pro-parenting, for lack of a better word. You know, so it's either pro-family, pro-parenting, a place where they can go get some great information to help them be better caregivers to their children, or it's something that they can bring their whole family to, you know. So that's what we want. When folks see the April is Pammy logo, they know that it's pro-parents, pro-family, and those kind of things. And so we launch the initiative every year with a breakfast where we kind of, the point is to kind of rev up the community to focus on as parents for a month, right? And to do things to recognize them, honor them, and those kind of things. And then what we do throughout the month is partner with organizations, get our PAMI logo on there so that it makes parents aware that this is an event that's either going to help me as a parent or it's going to help me do family-oriented things with my kids.
What do you think the biggest challenges are for parents in parenting?
I think that the biggest challenge is when we get stuck in, as we learn, as we as human beings progress, we learn more things, right? So we have to make changes to stuff. A lot of times, I think we fear change because we give it this personal value, you know, to our identity, meaning that, you know, we weren't smart enough or that we aren't good enough or whatever, as opposed to realizing things change. you know, this wouldn't be life if it didn't change. And so allow yourself to be wrong, because you will, as we learn more, you'll find things that were stat may not be stat anymore. And so be willing to, you know, especially if something isn't working out that you're trying to do, that you learned from a parent or you saw somebody else do, that you reach out and get information about that, because maybe they've learned something. We've got a different generation who responds to things differently because they have this thing called technology that we didn't have. You know, so don't be afraid to reach out and get that information that you need. It's not a negative reflection on you if you come up on something that you don't know. And I think that that's a lot of the issue that we see with the parents that we work with, is that fear factor of being judged on some level, and I think that that's really sad. I think that blame is such a strong word, but I think it's a part of our culture, you know, to have this air of self-sufficiency and that I know everything and that I can do everything. And if I could do anything, I would change that and realize that it's okay that we need each other, because as human beings, we need each other. You know, there are gifts that you have, Sharon, that I will never have. So my knowing you is a benefit to both of us, because I can give things to you and you can give things to me, right? And so I think that part of the American way really de-emphasizes that critical component and instead pushes you to be the superhero, you know, that can do everything. And I'm like, I would love to see that go away, so you have less and less parents being reluctant to go and ask for help.
So the parents who come to you to ask for help, they think they should be able to do it all themselves, everything?
Yeah, I think that they think they should be able to do it all themselves. Or you have people who are the help givers, making them feel less than worthwhile because you had to come and get help. In other words, we need to get over this stigma, for lack of a better word, that if you need help, there's something wrong with you, because we all need help. Every last one of us on the planet needs help. So instead of whether the person comes to you feeling like something's wrong with them because they have to ask you for help, or the person that you're going to feeling that there's something lesser than you because you're asking for help, I think we need to get over that and realize that someone coming to you for help is your greatest calling, you know, or going to somebody to get help is your greatest calling, because how can you proceed forward without that assistance, without that information, you know, without those tools that will help you get to where it is that you need to go? So I think that, I mean, that's a lot of what we see. There are generational problems or problems of the day that they're dealing with, like with the substance abuse issue, education, because the education system is so challenging, you know, so they're dealing with those things as well. Understanding what their power is, you know, as they are trying to impact and positively influence their communities. So there's a lot of things they don't know, and so I just think that it's okay to not know, because how else can you know? To pretend like you know and make the wrong decisions because you don't know is not the wisest thing to do, just so that somebody else thinks that you're smart or that you know everything or whatever that component is. That's what I see. Mm. You know, they will tell you that there are challenges with X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, you know, that you can't get a good job or these kind of things. But there are so many resources out there that they don't know about because they don't say, you know, this is a challenge that I'm having, and can you come in? Are you willing to assist me to move to the next level?
Any other events coming up for your organization coming anytime soon, or any classes you wanted to mention that you guys are offering?
The classes that we have coming up, we do a basic parenting class that's called Birth to 18. It meets every Wednesday from 10 to 12 here at our offices. It's a great kind of refresher to get questions answered and just to get to an understanding of the general trends involved in developing that really healthy parent-child relationship. We also have some classes going on that deal with specific issues. A lot of the families that we work with, they have specific issues that they're dealing with, like they're going through recovery or they're dealing with poor behavior of their students in school and trying to figure out how to work with that, with their student to get beyond what that behavior is trying to express, what internal issue that behavior is trying to express, whether the child's afraid, unhappy, bored, you know, so that they can effectively redirect that behavior to something positive by getting the child engaged in something positive so that they won't be expressing the negative situation that may be going on inside of them, you know, as they're trying to deal with life and as they're growing and as their hormones are going crazy, you know, all of these things as they're maturing. So we have a truancy. We work with the Gary City Court to do a truancy program. We work with some of the schools to do an infraction program. We call it an anti-suspension program, which is really good. 21st Century Charter Schools is one of the schools that we're working with on that, and Morton High School in Hammond. And we are getting ready to do some classes for women struggling with homelessness, you know, who are working with shelters or trying to get placed in a home, to really help them develop the family that can support sustenance as they move toward a stable home environment, home ownership, those kind of things. Our focus is really getting them to understand the importance of that parent-child relationship and how it impacts their relationships outside of the home as well as within the home, so that as the child and them go through life and go through life's ups and downs, which means life's accomplishments and challenges, that having a relationship that kind of gives you safety with it, or confidence even in those challenges, is critical to seeing some really good outcomes happen in not only the parent's life but the child's life as well. And so that's what we really look to promote with the families that we work with.
Thanks so much, Janae. Appreciate it.
No problem. We, like I said, we partner with events that are going on in the community that are family-focused or providing information that parents, that we believe that parents really should know about, and we'll put the PAMI logo on it so parents will know what they're getting going into that event. And so we had two really great events really about substance use, because, you know, prom's coming up and kids are going to do the alcohol thing. So we worked with, I believe it's Maryville Drug Free Communities, to do an event about that, and had a girl come out who she showed pictures of the accident that she had after prom. She should not be alive, but she was blessed to continue to live, to share her story, to get kids to not end up like she did, you know, and her best friend, who was valedictorian, died in that crash. So we did that event, and then we did another event on the 14th to inform parents about where kids hide drugs in their bedrooms today. It's called Wake Up Call, and it was done by Highland High School. So we try and support those kind of events so that we can make our parents knowledgeable in the area of where their kids are concerned. And so all we ask for the remainder of the month is that if your community or your church or your company, give yourself a day where you guys acknowledge your parents and you thank your parents and you let them know that you're there for them for the challenges that they're going through. And if they have any questions, you know, you'll help to get them connected to resources in the community that can help them move beyond that specific challenge. We just want to put that sort of challenge out to the community and to organizations and agencies within the community to, you know, give a shout out to your parents, man, and let them know they're not alone as they raise our future leaders.
Thank you so much. Anything else you wanted to add?
Just everybody have a great April. Love on your parents. Let them know that that you support them so that we can ensure that things like Prevent Child Abuse Month eventually can go away. The whole idea here, I think, for all of us agencies that are engaged in helping families and citizens struggling with things, is that one day they won't need us. So, you know, let's do what we need to do so that we can have that world where we won't need some of these things like Prevent Child Abuse Month, you know?
On its website, the Indiana Parenting Institute has a page that's called Relive the Moment, in which Jana says that it places photos and videos and recaps of some of all kinds of things from the organization's events. And you can take a look at that page. And in fact, you can go back in the archives all the way back to 2012. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Dr. Indra Frank is the Hoosier Environmental Council's Environmental Health Director, and she made a trip to suburban Washington, D.C. this week to talk about a very important rule that affects Hoosiers here in the state and our health. She's back from Washington, D.C. area, and she's with us to talk about what she had to say before this panel here. Dr. Frank, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Yeah, Chris, it's good to talk with you.
Well, first off, tell us about this group that you were testifying before this week on in Washington, D.C. on this issue.
This was a hearing before the staff members of the Environmental Protection Agency, accepting hearing on a proposal to alter the rules regarding coal ash disposal.
Tell us, if you will, here a little bit about the importance of maintaining these rules, especially as it pertains to Indiana, because the coal ash problem is a big one as far as the health and safety of Hoosiers are concerned, is it not?
Yeah, it certainly is. Indiana has long depended on coal for our electricity. And when we burn coal, there's an ash left over that unfortunately has a lot of toxic heavy metals in it. So disposal of that ash is really important. If we don't dispose of it carefully, it can contaminate water. A rule was passed in 2015 regarding disposal of coal ash. And now under the new administration in Washington, the EPA is proposing to weaken that rule significantly. The Hoosier Environmental Council has worked on coal ash for nearly 20 years, or coal ash issues, mm-hmm. and trying to protect our water resources from coal ash. So I was sent to tell EPA about the situation in Indiana and why we feel the rules should not be weakened.
If you'd like, go down to some of the points that you mentioned in your testimony before the EPA staff about the problem with coal ash here in Indiana and why it's so important to keep these rules in effect.
Sure. So in Indiana, we have 15 power plants that are regulated by those coal ash rules. And just last month, they were required to publish reports on the status of their groundwater at their coal ash disposal sites. What we learned from those reports is that at every one of those sites, the groundwater has been contaminated by metals from the coal ash to the extent that it's now unfit for human consumption. So we'd like to make sure that there are protections going forward so that we don't continue the contamination. I testified to the EPA that it's important not to weaken the groundwater protection standards, and the current proposal at the EPA would weaken them. EPA's proposal would also weaken the cleanup requirements for contaminated sites. It would weaken the requirements for responses to coal ash spills. It would also allow coal ash disposal in dangerous locations like floodplains, wetlands, or fault zones. And another aspect of this proposal that's currently at the EPA is that it would remove the current transparency requirements that allow us to see what kinds of contamination are happening due to coal ash.
I know that the concern that everybody has is, and you mentioned here about the transparency, about the rules and the procedures in particular, that may even allow for regular cleanups would probably go away or certainly be curtailed if some of the rules were changed, would it not?
Right, yes. I'm afraid some of the changes that are being proposed would curtail cleanup.
When you gave your testimony to the panel there in suburban Washington this week here, you mentioned some very serious chemicals and compounds that seem to be in the coal ash. Would you run down the list and kind of outline some of these concerns of what from the power plants here in Indiana that the data was mm-hmm. gathered from, please?
Sure. So the staff at Hoosier Environmental Council have reviewed all of the groundwater reports from our regulated power plants. And what we found in those is that the coal ash is contaminating the groundwater. 80% of the sites were contaminated with molybdenum. 80% were contaminated with sulfate above drinking water health standards. Mm-hmm. In fact, with the molybdenum, most of those exceeded the molybdenum standard by 20. Well, now let me think about this. I know it was half of them exceeded the molybdenum health standard by 20-fold or more. 73% of the sites are contaminated with boron exceeding the drinking water health standard. All but one of our power plants had arsenic in the groundwater exceeding the drinking water standard as well. Some of the sites also show contamination with lithium, radium, cobalt, and cadmium, and that varies more from site to site. So it kind of depends on which ash or which coal they were burning mm-hmm. and what pollution controls they had in place at the site.
I suppose that is probably one of the key points is that we know that that there are various types of coal, of course, that can be used in powering up power plants. And Indiana power plants do have an option, I suppose, in choosing one coal over the other, what's available, I suppose. And so it is a good, not that any of it apparently has some kind of chemicals in it that obviously that after it's burned that goes into the ash. But there's a way, I guess, to have been able to make it less contaminative possible?
Well, it's just that in the groundwater data, what I saw varied from one location to another. I don't have information on exactly what would have caused those variations. At a couple of sites, though, we do know that they have impermeable liners built under the coal ash disposal. And at those sites, we did notice that there was less contamination of the groundwater. So there's more protection there.
So it'd be better, obviously, to at least have it properly handled, such as what you'd have to do for a solid waste landfill for a coal ash pit of some type, rather than just digging a hole in the ground and filling it up with coal ash, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, with this material, there really aren't too many good ways of disposing of it.
Right.
But a lot of our coal ash right now in Indiana is sitting in the floodplain of our rivers or of Lake Michigan, and we have shallow aquifers in those locations, so it's easier to contaminate the groundwater. Yeah, it's more protected for our water resources if the ash can go to landfills on high ground with impermeable liners underneath.
And speaking of these hearings that were held here, and the one in which you testified at in near Washington this week, what indication do you get from the EPA staff? They're either going to have more hearings, or they're going to make some decision anytime in the near future about these rules, ruling on coal ash disposal and handling. Do you get any kind of indication from EPA at all that they're going to make any changes anytime soon?
Well, Chris, that's an excellent question. This process is being rushed somewhat. The first time the coal ash rules were written and promulgated in 2015, that process took several years and included a great deal of public input and scientific input as well. At that time, the EPA held hearings at multiple locations around the country. This time, with these revisions that they've proposed, they have reduced the public comment period to only 45 days. They held a single hearing. The opportunity for public comment is still open now, though. If anyone would like to do so, it's open through April 30th, and we have instructions on how to comment at indianacoalash.org.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the hearing, the EPA staff listened and took notes, but they did not respond to any of the comments. There were people from all over the country, as well as Puerto Rico, talking about the coal ash locations that they were dealing with in their states and at their locations, and the reasons that this rule should not be weakened. I only heard one person testify in favor of the EPA's current proposal during this day-long hearing. During the hearing, the EPA staff did not make any response, and I believe that's part of their protocol. Their plan, or the plan that has been put forward by EPA, is to go through the public comment that's been received, either written or in testimony, and make revisions to their proposal. And they've announced that they intend to have the next draft of their proposal out in September. So they're trying to move this fairly rapidly for a major regulation.
Yeah, so it certainly sounds that way, since it took so long with so much deliberative thought and planning, with all the research that went into it to enact the rules in the first place, that it seems like they are speeding this along to try to be able to dismantle the entire procedure.
Yeah, there is. There was a large coalition of groups, environmental and public health groups, that made an official request to the EPA to extend the public comment period and to add additional public hearings, but that request was denied.
Well, Dr. Frank, thank you very much for that. Let's hope that we get something positive, at least for us, as far as the state of our environment here in Indiana by September, at least that they'll decide not to change the rules or dismantle the procedure altogether. We've been talking with Dr. Indra Frank, who is the Environmental Health Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. She attended a hearing by the EPA staff in suburban Washington, D.C. this week, talking about the coal ash rules, the problem of coal ash pollution, and how the rules should not be changed. And Dr. Frank, thank you very much for spending time with us, and we'll have to, I guess, wait and see what the EPA decides to do.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It's good talking with you.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this Thursday and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And we want to thank the guests for joining us on the program today. From the Indianapolis Star, Matt Tully, and from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Rob Earnshaw. And thanks to Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson, for her interview. And from the Hoosier Environmental Council, Dr. Indra Frank. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.